Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 8th of February, these are our main stories. Hong Kong has introduced strict quarantine rules to contain the spread of the coronavirus from mainland China and has threatened to jail people who break them. A United Nations report has concluded that Spain is failing people in poverty. And nearly 600,000 people have now been displaced by fighting in northwest Syria since December. Also in this podcast,
Antarctica is strange in terms of how it's responding to climate change. You know, we hear a lot about the sea ice reducing.
The Antarctic continent has recorded its highest temperature since readings there began nearly 60 years ago. The authorities in Hong Kong have introduced strict quarantine rules to contain the spread of the coronavirus from mainland China, with the threat of jail for anyone who breaches them. Hong Kong citizens returning from the mainland will have to stay inside their homes for 14 days, while foreigners must isolate themselves in hotel rooms or go to government-run centres. Sophia Chan is Hong Kong's Secretary for Health.
The mandatory quarantine for 14 days. There are a number of checkings and also medical surveillance, as well as looking into the condition of the quarantine at home. But the whole idea is really for this person to stay at home and not to go out in case they carry any virus, that it would not be transmitted to the rest of the community.
Usually tens of thousands of people arrive in Hong Kong from mainland China every day. This week, thousands of medical workers in the territory have been on strike, calling for the border to be closed. Hong Kong has seen 25 cases of the virus, including one death. As it continues to spread, controls and restrictions are increasing across China, where more than 600 people have now died and more than 31,000 have been infected. Our China correspondent, John Sudworth, has been monitoring developments from Beijing.
In some cities, the infected are being rounded up, with multiple unverified videos showing the quarantine squads at work. It's all adding to a growing sense of disbelief and dread. I don't want to be taken away like that, a child can be heard saying in one video, as outside the window, two people are forced into what looks like a metal box. But the fear is turning to anger. Dr. Li Wenliang was one of the first to report signs of the new strange virus. But his online posts were censored, and the police made him sign a confession, along with seven others, for spreading rumours. Now, his death from the virus in a Wuhan hospital has prompted an outpouring on social media. The hashtag, I want freedom of speech, viewed almost 2 million times before being blocked. Others have been posting artwork showing Dr. Li wearing a mask of barbed wire. Dr. Li was the first whistleblower, but no one cared, this man tells me.
Are you angry?
Yes, a bit, this woman says. If they'd listened to him, the situation would be better now. The response, though, is likely to be more censorship. Earlier this week, I spoke to a lawyer and blogger, Chen Qiushi, who was in Wuhan trying to film and report.
What's your thoughts about how long you will be able to continue providing independent reporting from Wuhan?
I'm not sure, he says. The censorship is very strict and people's accounts are being closed if they share my content. His family say he's now disappeared. In this public health disaster, there are real political risks, and the orders are already being sent out. Maintain stability, tighten control.
That was John Sudworth. Now, many people are also asking questions about how the young and apparently healthy doctor Li Wenliang could succumb to the virus. He was in his early 30s and not considered among the groups most at risk. Our medical correspondent Fergus Walsh has been following developments.
Dr. Li Wenliang was 34 years old. Now, we don't have his medical records, so we don't know whether he had some underlying condition. But it's not a complete surprise. About 80% of those who've died have been elderly with underlying health conditions, but that means about one in five haven't. And even seasonal flu can sometimes kill people who are young and previously completely healthy. Also, as one of the very first doctors to have come across the infection and, in fact, raise the alarm about it, he would have been seeing patients without any protection at all. And healthcare workers, we've known this from other viruses like SARS 16 years ago, some nurses who were doing cleaning of the lungs of patients risk a very heavy dose. And if he had a very heavy dose, that in itself can mean a worse infection, because if you get a high dose very early on, it can overwhelm your immune system before it has time to respond. Whereas if you get infected by somebody in passing contact and just a small amount of virus comes in, it allows your time for your immune system to respond.
If you do get this illness, the people who have this illness, what treatment is available for them?
So all sorts of things are being tried. Antiviral treatments are being tried because, of course, antibiotics don't work against viruses. They're trying the sort of antiviral treatments they've tried against swine flu. And what they can do is support people. They can put them on a respirator, give them oxygen. They can give them steroid treatment. There are no specific treatments. But the vast majority, we got over 30,000 cases, but it's estimated that in China alone, we've probably got maybe 300,000. So the modelling suggests we've got 10 times as many. And that's good news and it's bad news. It's good news because it means the vast majority will get mild illness. It's bad news because it makes it much harder to contain a virus which in most cases causes a mild infection.
That was Fergus Walsh. The spread of the new coronavirus across China and beyond has created a global shortage of protective medical equipment. The head of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, says demand for items such as face masks, gloves and respirators is up to 100 times higher than normal and prices 20 times higher. At a news conference in Geneva, he urged sellers not to hoard equipment to push up prices.
When supply is short and demand is high, there could be bad practices like hoarding in order to sell them at higher prices. And that's why we ask for solidarity and for people to really understand what fighting an outbreak like coronavirus is and to uphold the protection of humanity rather than running for their profits.
Mr. Ghebreyesus said he'd spoken to manufacturers and distributors to ensure that supplies reached those who needed them most, especially medical professionals. Someone who's been manufacturing surgical masks and respirators for some time is Mike Bowen of Prestige Ameritech near Dallas in Texas. James Kumarasamy asked him, how many does he make?
We make millions and millions of masks. The building that we're in the 90s, made about 90% of the U.S. mask supply. Today it makes about 5 because America's hospitals and even America's government have elected to save a penny or two on a mask and they buy foreign-made masks. So,
and when you say foreign made, are many of those coming from China?
Yes, about half of the U.S. supply comes from China. So, the U.S. mask supply is in peril right now because I read in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, I think, that Chinese officials are now taking over mask factories. And the word that I'm getting from more than one source is that they're starting to tell these mask companies not to send masks outside. So, if they get to the factories that supply the big U.S. distributors that are selling masks here, there's going to be a massive mask shortage. And we already have the supply here is already stretched tight as a drum. So imagine if half of it went away.
So you can't suddenly boost your manufacturing to meet, to a certain extent, the demand?
No, nobody can. It's too little, too late.
That was Mike Bowen of Prestige Ameritech in Texas. In China, the electronics firm Foxconn, which makes iPhones, is hoping to make up for some of the shortfall by switching some of its production lines to make face masks. To other news now, the United Nations has warned that a humanitarian catastrophe is unfolding in the province of Idlib in northwest Syria. UN aid agencies estimate that nearly 600,000 people have been forced from their homes in the past 2 months as government forces backed by Russia continue to seize ground in the last remaining area still in rebel hands. Our Middle East correspondent Martin Patience sent this report from Beirut.
For weeks, Russian warplanes have been pounding targets in Idlib, including hospitals and bakeries, forcing hundreds of thousands to flee northwards towards the Turkish border. More than 200 civilians have been killed since the start of the year. And this man in Idlib says no one is taking any chances.
Every time when I'm coming home, I see cars loaded with people and their belongings. I see children shuddering from cold, and they are moving to the unknown.
Now government forces have entered the strategically important town of Sarakib, where state TV showed footage of bombed-out buildings and bodies lying in the streets. The Syrian regime has vowed to retake every inch of the territory still under the control of rebels, most of whom are jihadists. But Idlib, the last opposition stronghold in the country, is home to 3 million civilians. And the UN is warning of a humanitarian disaster if the offensive continues. Mark Katz is the UN coordinator for the Syria crisis.
It's a horrific situation. We rarely see displacement on this scale. 600,000 people who fled their homes in the last 2 months alone. There's more people moving at the moment. They're just moving in all directions, trying to get away from the fighting and very active front lines.
Turkey, which backs some of the rebels fighting the Syrian regime, has repeatedly called on Damascus to halt this offensive. Ankara has warned that if it doesn't, then Turkey will have to take matters into its own hands.
That was Martin Patience. The lawyer of a US National Security Council official who was a key witness in President Trump's impeachment inquiry says his client, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman, has been sacked from his White House job. From Washington, here's Gary O'Donoghue.
Lieutenant Colonel Vindman was escorted out of the White House, according to his lawyer, who said he'd lost his job for telling the truth, accusing the president of exacting revenge. His client was one of the first to give evidence, appearing on Capitol Hill in full dress uniform and telling the inquiry that he couldn't believe what he was hearing during the call in which the president asked his Ukrainian counterpart to launch investigations into his political rivals in the US. Earlier, the president was asked about Vindman and said, "I'm not happy with him. You think I'm supposed to be happy with him?" This move will fuel speculation that the president plans to take further retribution, particularly after his press secretary said how horribly he was treated and that maybe people should pay for that.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. A senior UN envoy has said that Spain is utterly failing people in poverty. Philip Alston issued the warning at the end of a 12-day tour of the country. Here's our Europe regional editor, Mike Sanders.
Philip Alston is the UN Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty, and it's his job to look at a country's underbelly. British ministers called his description of their country last year unrecognisable. In Spain, he said the conditions for migrant workers were probably the worst he'd ever seen. Roma people were living on rubbish dumps, he said. Some families had to choose between eating and heating. A completely inadequate social protection system left large numbers in poverty by design, he added, blaming an abnormally low tax take. The one bright spot was the new left-wing minister's commitment to social justice, he said, challenging them to achieve it.
Mike Sanders. The Antarctic continent has recorded its highest temperature since readings there began in 1961. The Argentine Research Centre at Esperanza shared the record-breaking reading for Thursday on social media. Our science and environment reporter Victoria Gill told us more.
Basically, it was a temperature reading from the station there that logged 18.3 degrees C. So that is for the Antarctic continent, not for the whole region of Antarctica, but for the Antarctic continent, a record. It beats the last record, which was actually only set on the Antarctic continent in the exact same place in 2015 by 0.8 degrees.
So I understand that Antarctica's peninsula is one of the fastest warming places on Earth. Why is that? Do we know?
It is. Well, I think Antarctica is strange in terms of how it's responding to climate change. You know, we hear a lot about the sea ice reducing year by year, the maximum sea ice reducing generally in the overall pattern in the Arctic. But in Antarctica, there are some really strange overall effects. And that's partly because it's this huge land mass rather than this huge ice mass surrounded by land. So it's very different from the Arctic. And the Antarctic Peninsula is, if you look at a map of Antarctica, which is utterly vast, it's this tiny looking little spindle that sort of sticks out very far north to and reaches out towards Argentina at the top. And topographically, it's quite strange. It's got some very high mountains. So the climate there is quite particular and the weather patterns there are particular. Now, what's driving these weather patterns and this reading is, in actual fact, these warm winds that blow down from the mountain in that region that are known as the Fone winds. So that's a weather pattern that we've seen driving that record-breaking temperature in 2015, and that's what's driven this temperature now. But what scientists at the British Antarctic Survey that I've spoken to you said is that those wind patterns, those weather-generating patterns, and the overall signal of climate change in the whole of that region are contributing to this driving force for these record-breaking temperatures. So it's the fact that we've had two record-breaking temperatures in such quick succession suggests that this is a signal of this uptick of these extreme events happening in the Antarctic Peninsula, and that the driving force behind them, the signal that's pushing that, is climate change.
And that little sound that you heard in the audio was almost certainly your phone, definitely not ours. That was our science and environment reporter, Victoria Gill. Still to come in this podcast.
There's a fantastic letter to his butler before a party, and it's so exacting and says exactly what the butler should do.
Rare letters written by the English writer Charles Dickens are going on display for the first time. Botswana has held its first auction to sell licenses to trophy hunters to kill a total of 70 elephants. Last year, the government lifted a hunting ban, provoking strong criticism from environmental groups. The licenses were bought by safari companies, with reports of packages selling for more than $400,000. Our correspondent Nomsa Maseko reports.
Botswana is home to about 130,000 elephants, more than any other country. With this year's hunting season less than 2 months away, the government has sold 7 hunting licenses, each of them allowing hunters to kill 10 elephants in designated areas and to take the trophies abroad. Only companies registered in Botswana were allowed to bid for the licenses. Last year, President Mokgweetsi Masisi revoked the 5-year-old ban on hunting elephants, arguing that with the increasing human population, the animals posed a threat to people's lives and crops. Conservationists disagree. Ros Harvey is an environmental economist from South Africa.
There's no scientific evidence to support the view of there being too many elephants. Scientifically, we know that Botswana's elephant numbers haven't actually increased over the last 5 years. We have a stable population. Elephants are critical to Botswana's ecology.
But rural communities believe a return to commercial hunting will help keep the elephant population away from their villages and also bring in much-needed income in places unsuited for high-end tourism.
That was Nomsa Maseko. Now, how do you get to work in the morning? In Nigeria, there's been widespread disruption in the commercial capital Lagos after a ban on motorbikes, commonly used along with tricycles as a form of taxi. The authorities say the ban is due to safety fears and they will now improve official public transport. But it's had a huge impact on the countless commuters who normally rely on the motorbike taxis called Okada. Sasha Twining spoke to Yemisi Adegoke on a busy street in Lagos.
An Okada is basically a motorbike taxi, and they're a popular mode of transport in Lagos because it's a really densely populated city. It's really difficult to get around here. There's a lot of traffic. And Okadas are really helpful because you can kind of dart in and out of cars, and they're much faster than sitting in a car. So they're quite popular. They're affordable as well. Not many people in Lagos can actually afford to buy cars. So motorbike taxis and keke marawas are extremely popular.
And we can hear some of the traffic noise around you, Yemisi. Just describe just how busy this city is.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Lagos is notorious for traffic. It's not unusual for people to spend lots and lots of hours trying to get to and from work. And this ban has really, really affected it. It's made it much, much worse for people. They're spending much longer in traffic. I'm surrounded by traffic at the moment. It's been like this all morning. It'll probably stay like this for the rest of the day. People are really, really suffering as a result of this ban.
Yemisi Adegoke in Nigeria. The British government has appointed a new ambassador to the United States months after its previous envoy stepped down when he was sidelined by President Trump. Karen Pierce is currently Britain's ambassador to the United Nations. Here's our diplomatic correspondent, James Landale.
Karen Pierce comes to the role with a huge task ahead of her. UK-US relations are at a low ebb after disagreements about Iran, Huawei and digital taxes, along with a diplomatic row over a US citizen's involvement in a car crash that killed a British teenager. But the UK's first female ambassador to the United States is well qualified for the task. A career diplomat since 1981, she's served all over the world and knows the US well. Her challenge now will be to help secure a trade deal between the US and post-Brexit Britain.
That was James Landale. Now, here is a story that could have come straight out of the pages of a classic spy novel. Cue music. The unmistakable sound there from the Ypres File, the classic mid-60s espionage film. What do you mean you haven't seen it? But this is a tale from Credit Suisse that started back in September and has culminated in the resignation on Friday of the company's boss, Tijan Tiam. Here's our Geneva correspondent, Imogen Folks.
It's a good old-fashioned spying scandal. What we know is that former star wealth manager of Credit Suisse, Iqbal Khan, who had moved to rival bank UBS, spotted somebody following him down a major Zurich street when he was out for a walk with his wife and confronted him, and it turned out to be a private detective hired by Credit Suisse. Now, we can understand it that, you know, a wealth manager has wealthy clients that a bank wants to keep. You may be a bit disappointed and worried that he's going to take clients with him. But the banks theoretically have regulations about that. What they're not supposed to do is spy on former employees. So this came out not long after it emerged that this wealth manager wasn't the only person that Credit Suisse had been spying on. Apparently, they'd also had a detective looking at their former human resources manager. And it looks like they were also having a look at Greenpeace. Now, the environmental groups have been focusing on the big Swiss banks and their investment in fossil fuels and taking direct action against them. And apparently, Credit Suisse was trying to find out, you know, what Greenpeace might be planning. And it just doesn't look good. This is not what people expect of a bank. And in the end, the CEO, Tijan Tiam, has had to fall on his sword, but not before a really pretty, like, blood on the floor of the boardrooms at Credit Suisse.
Imogen Folks in Geneva. Mr. Tiam has denied any wrongdoing. Letters written by the 19th century English writer Charles Dickens, which reveal his state of mind while he worked on some of his most famous novels, are going on display for the first time. The 25 previously unpublished documents are part of a large collection of manuscripts, books, sketches and portraits acquired by the Charles Dickens Museum in London. The great-great-great-granddaughter of the writer, Lucinda Hawksley, says the material is so important.
It gives us a wonderful insight into Dickens's personality. There's a fantastic letter to his butler before a party, and it's so exacting and says exactly what the butler should do. Just these little minutiae of life, but also some really important things in terms of history of art, several works by great illustrators, and the unpublished letters, and all sorts of other information about Dickens.
That letter to the butler, by the way, includes instructions to ensure a secret supply of gin punch is kept under the table, just for Dickens and one other guest. Well, our arts correspondent Rebecca Jones has been looking at the material.
The paper itself is folded up and becomes the envelope. With great care, Cindy Chagrou, director of the Charles Dickens Museum, opens a letter written by one of Britain's most popular and prolific novelists.
And you can still see the remains of the wax seal that Dickens would use.
It's one of a number of letters written by Dickens, which provide a fascinating insight into his life and work. One is dated the 9th of November 1843 and was sent to a close friend. Dickens wrote it while he was working on A Christmas Carol.
So he's making reference to, I'll just get to the right bit, "I have half done the Christmas book," that's A Christmas Carol, "and am resting for 2 days before going to Chuzzlewit." It's Martin Chuzzlewit. "That is, if I can call anything rest with that before me."
Another unpublished letter was written in 1846, when Dickens and his family went to stay in Switzerland for several months. At the time, he was starting work on Dombey and Son. Cindy Chagrou says the letter goes some way to answering the question, what did Dickens do to help himself write?
"It is a tough day, but it is a great thing to get rid of the heat. I have been writing my head off since 10 o'clock. And then he finishes by saying, "I may perhaps take a boat for exercise this evening after dinner." So it's this mixture of being on holiday, enjoying a completely different culture, and still meeting those publication deadlines throughout.
Other letters reveal Charles Dickens' strained relationship with his father. And while Dickens destroyed most of the letters sent to him, there is also the only complete exchange of letters that survives between Dickens and one of his fans, a young Danish woman. The collection will now be conserved before being put online and on display at the museum later in the year.
That was Rebecca Jones. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast tomorrow. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, or have your butler drop round a nice handwritten letter. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.
The Compass is the BBC World Service podcast that explores big ideas.
We have a tendency in science, when we talk about the intelligence of animals, to go for things that we are good at. So we are good at language. If you have a talking ape, people are extremely impressed, or a talking parrot for that matter. But other skills we don't care much about.
And how those big ideas shape the world around us.
Animals are more or less a symbol of an economic system that has a dead end, that it's all focused on production and consumption. Animals are suffering and we do not take care of each other anymore.
The Compass Podcast from the BBC World Service.
She's an intelligent, social, autonomous being. She needs her freedom.
Search for The Compass wherever you get your podcasts.